This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, welcome to the show. Steve Roberts, longtime political analyst and Washington-based reporter. At least I think most of your career has been in Washington or New York. And welcome to the show.
Well, I'm delighted to be with you. I spent 5 years as a correspondent in California and 4 years as a foreign correspondent in Greece. Some people think I spent 5 years as a foreign correspondent in Los Angeles, but
that might be the view. That might be the view here as well.
Yeah. So I'm delighted to be with you and help you understand whatever's going on.
Well, you know, we spoke on Super Tuesday evening, and I asked you a question. I said, this situation with Biden coming back from a virtual life support situation, I asked if it was unprecedented, and I think you more or less, your answer, your short version of your answer was yes. And I've considered that, and I've mulled around what a lot of people have thought about this, and the best answer I've heard from anybody is that the closest analogy anybody can come up with is Dewey beats Truman.
Well, I'm old, but that even that one is before my time. It is unprecedented. I think the whole speed of politics has just speeded up so much, in part because of the digital age, and people get information and react so much more quickly than they did. The whole pace of politics is much faster. But I think the what really happened on Super Tuesday and has happened since then in states like Michigan and Missouri is driven by one word, and that word is fear. Joe Biden has not been reborn as some energetic, young, silver-tongued, charismatic character, right? He's still old Joe. He's still 77 years old. He's still lacking in energy. He's still lacking in eloquence. But what happened is that Democrats, both voters and candidates like Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar, Cory Booker, all came to the same conclusion, which is one, their fear of Trump was so great. I go beyond fear. Their loathing of Trump was so great that they all decided in one form or another that they had to coalesce around one candidate. And secondly, their fear of Bernie Sanders was so great that they decided it had to be Biden as an alternative to Sanders. So what's driving the Biden campaign right now is a lot of energy and a lot of emotion, but it's largely negative, not positive. This is not people suddenly discovering that Joe Biden would be a great candidate or a great president. When Amy Klobuchar said just the other day, people are looking for a rock, a safe place. I think that is exactly what people are looking for in Biden. Now, a safe place is not exactly a great bumper sticker, right? I mean, this is not Barack Obama's hope and change. This is not Bill Clinton, the comeback kid. This is a very different tone, but it might fit the times. And so there's a strong wave of energy in the Democratic Party, but it's almost entirely at this point negative energy, anti-Trump and anti-Sanders, not necessarily pro-Biden.
So the bumper sticker sounds like fear and loathing.
Well, yes. And as I say, Biden is still Biden. Biden's got a lot of drawbacks as a candidate. Bernie Sanders hopes to highlight those in the debate this weekend. And there's a reason why Joe Biden, who ran for president twice before and was a miserable presidential candidate, there are reasons why he still has a lot of flaws as a candidate. He's at this point, as I say, he's the receptacle of all of these feelings in the Democratic Party. You know, you go back to 2016 when Bernie Sanders came very close to beating Hillary Clinton. I think there were two things at work there that are not true this year. One is, there was a much stronger antipathy to Clinton than there is toward Biden. People really did not like Hillary Clinton and were sick of the Clintons. And It's now obvious that a significant part of the Sanders strength 4 years ago was anti-Clinton. At that point, even after the nomination, after Sanders gave a late and very grudging endorsement of Clinton, one out of five Sanders voters did not vote for Hillary Clinton, according to all academic studies I've seen.
And enough to have tilted the election in those three upper Midwestern states.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But the other factor was Donald Trump was still an idea. He wasn't a fact. And I think the crystallization of the threat that Donald Trump poses to progressive values is much more tangible today than it was 4 years ago. He has named almost 200 federal judges, including two Supreme Court judges. I wrote a column this week saying happy birthday, Ruth Ginsburg, because Ruth Ginsburg turned 87 this week. And if any Sanders supporter wants to have a glimmer of why elections have consequences, just contemplate what the Supreme Court could look like after four more years of Donald Trump, when he almost certainly will have a chance to appoint Ruth Ginsburg's successor and probably Stephen Breyer's successor as well. So there's a very different dynamic going on in the Democratic Party today than 4 years ago. People are, they might not love Joe Biden, but there isn't that same animosity that was directed toward Clinton in a lot of circles, and the fear of Trump is vastly magnified after having watched him for 3.5 years.
There's one anecdote or a tidbit from a Michigan exit poll that there's pretty much what we've seen all around the country, but voters in that exit poll were asked, who would you rather vote for, somebody who will defeat Trump or somebody who agrees with you on all the issues? It was 58-37, and that's a Michigan citation, but it's very similar to what I've seen all around the country. It bolsters your point.
Right. That's about what the Sanders vote is. It's about 37.
Yep.
He's never been a majority candidate. He looked so good after Nevada and after New Hampshire because the Democratic field was so fragmented. There was always a floor under Bernie Sanders' vote because he does have a hardcore support. He has a very loyal base that also gives him money, which gives him, you know, as you and I both know, one of the reasons why people like Klobuchar, Booker, Kamala Harris drop out is because they run out of money. Sanders not going to run out of money because he has a base of very loyal supporters who continue to contribute. But it quickly became clear once the field cleared that his upper limit was somewhere around 37-40%. He got 43% of the vote, I think, against Clinton and 46% of the delegates. But he is not and never has been close to being a majority candidate in the Democratic Party.
We'll take a break here. I'll tease the question that I want to ask you in return. You interestingly referred to the animosity toward the Clintons in the plural. There are many, and particularly women, who've suggested that there was unique animosity towards Hillary Clinton because she was a woman. I'd like to tease that out and get your thoughts on that when we return in just a moment in the think tank. We're here with Steve Roberts.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back here with Washington reporter Steve Roberts. The question that I posed before the break, you were reviewing the 2016 election and that Hillary Clinton was, in retrospect, a very weak candidate. A lot of people have suggested that that was a woman and that those negatives would have been imposed on anyone. What's your take on to what extent was that a factor, or what was it Clinton in the plural Clinton fatigue?
I think there were, it's hard to quantify this, as you and I both know, but I do think there were elements of sexism in some quarters against Hillary Clinton. I don't think there's any question about that. I do not think it was the major reason she lost. I think that there were many reasons why she lost, including the fact that the single most important historical trend. Everybody says Donald Trump defied history, and that's all true except for one thing. There's one very bright trend that has held true now since the early 19th century when the Democratic Party was formed, which is that the Democratic Party has enormous difficulty electing a president for a third successive term. It's only happened twice in our entire history. It happened in 1836 when Andrew Jackson, one of the founders of the Democratic Party, was succeeded by his vice president, that great American hero, Martin Van Buren. And it happened when Franklin Roosevelt was reelected in the middle of World War II, which was a totally anomalous situation. When you think about Hillary Clinton, she was actually trying to run for two-third terms, Bills and Barack's. Mm-hmm. And with all of the baggage that came with that, that's not a random fact. You and I, as political scientists, know that's not a random fact. This is a reflection of a very deep-seated impulse in American politics. American politics goes in cycles, and the most powerful slogan in American politics is "It's time for change."
Yeah, throw the rascals out. Yeah.
And that's why the Democrats have had so much trouble. And whether it was Hubert Humphrey in 1968, whether it was Al Gore, they just have a terribly difficult time winning a third straight time, like Republicans do, too.
I was going to ask you, why is that uniquely a Democrat? It certainly is.
Democrat, but mm-hmm. you go back to the 19th century, the Republicans, won a lot of elections in a row. But the Democrats just have never done it. And it's also, I just think it is endemic to the American political DNA that they love change. And if you look at the successful Democratic candidates since World War II, every one of them has been able to portray himself as a candidate for change. Eliminate Truman and Johnson, who are already president. You get Kennedy, Carter, Clinton, Obama, only four Democrats.
Absolutely, they were. Absolutely.
First of all, their average age was only 47 years old. Secondly, each one could say, I'm the harbinger of a new wave, a new generation. Jack Kennedy, torch has been passed to a new generation. It meant the World War II veterans. Jimmy Carter came after Watergate and after Vietnam and after people were sick of being lied to. And he said, I'm never going to lie to you again. You had Bill Clinton, the first baby boomer, and Barack Obama, obviously the first president of color. That's the winning formula for Democrats. And so when you get Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton himself had worn out a lot of his welcome toward the end of his presidency. She just was so shop-worn, and she kept saying, I'm a change agent, right? And no one believed her. It was so totally absurd. And on top of that, she ran one of the worst campaigns in modern American political history. It was smug. It was self-delusional. I had students who worked for Hillary Clinton on 4 o'clock on the afternoon of election day. They were popping champagne corks in Brooklyn. They had no idea how badly she had begun to slip. They kept looking at their data and kept telling everybody who was sending alarms into Brooklyn, don't worry, our data says we're going to win by 4 points. And so do I think her gender was a problem with some voters? Yes, but the main reason she lost was this much longer range historic trend combined with her own ineptitude as a candidate.
Now, your theory about Democrats winning as change agents, that wouldn't seem to bode very well for Joe Biden.
Well, you're absolutely right about that. I have looked around all year with 20 plus Democratic candidates and said, who fits the template? And in fact, no one did. But this is such an anomalous time, and it's possible. And that's about as far as I'm willing to go at this point, because I'm not predicting anything. But it's certainly possible. Biden has actually seized on two ideas that I think are reasonably effective. On two Super Tuesday, when you and I talked, he had that line about I'm the candidate. I'm the candidate who's going to, if anybody who's been left behind and counted out and left behind, that's a very powerful idea in American politics. The hero who overcomes odds and obstacles. It was very much part of the you know, the Bill Clinton comeback kid idea. But the second idea is, you know, when he says, I'm the candidate of dignity or civility. I think the single biggest weakness that Donald Trump has is personal. It's not policy, it's personal. You look at the Pew Research Center this week, they ask people, do you like the way President Trump conducts himself in office? 83% had some reservations. Only 15% said they really liked the way he conducted his office. Only about 32% said he was morally upstanding or honest. That tells me that the opening for Democrats is that line that Biden has been honing, which is, I'm the candidate of civility. I'm the candidate of dignity. I'm the candidate of normalcy.
We'll be back with Steve Roberts in just a moment.
Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
By the way, we're here with Steve Roberts discussing American politics. Let me explain the exit music on the last one. I thought by that time I anticipated we would be talking in the end of the segment about the primary, and the gist of which was that the primary election is more or less over. Hence the music. It's all over now. Well, we had moved on to something else, and if that came across as a non sequitur, it was.
Look, it's largely over. I think there's one more turn here. Sanders gets to debate Biden one-on-one. We've seen before that Joe Biden is a poor debater. He's prone to confusion and garrulousness. And I don't think that the debate's going to create any significant turn, because I think people are so deeply committed to the idea that they have to unify behind him in order to stop Trump. As you pointed out earlier, stopping Trump is by far the most dominant impulse among Democrats. All the polls I'm looking at show huge leads for Biden in states like Florida that vote next week.
If anything, but the votes that are coming up look to be more favorable to Biden than the Super Tuesday states we've just had.
There's only one remaining question, and that is whether Biden self-destructs. Does he do something so damaging that causes people not to doubt, I mean, not to doubt his policies? It's all personal. You know, he is, I'm the same age as Joe Biden, right? And I know at 77 that you have your good days and your bad days. And he has a bad day when it comes to the debate. It could shake some people. But the real question for me going forward is not, is Biden going to get the nomination? The real question for me is, what does Sanders do? As we discussed earlier, there's no doubt in my mind that Hillary Clinton was absolutely correct when she blamed Bernie Sanders as one of the main reasons she lost. And Sanders gave his endorsement very late. It was very tepid. And more importantly, he sent a message to his most rabid followers, particularly impressionable young people, that the system was rigged against us, that her victory was unfair, that she is a tainted, impure candidate. And that was very damaging, as I said, particularly for young people who were new to politics and got very excited by the idea of free college tuition, all the other pie-in-the-sky promises from Bernie Sanders. And what does he do now? Does he continue to send a message to his troops like he did before, that Biden is not worth supporting? Or does he understand that the consequences are so great that he is obligated to do everything possible to defeat Trump? That, to me, is maybe the single biggest question to be answered over the next couple of weeks and months.
That is the question of the hour. I'd love to hear your thoughts on which way you think he'll go.
Well, I think he's given some hints that he's not going to be as damaging as he was before. First of all, he's made it very clear that he has more friendly feelings toward Joe Biden than he ever did toward Hillary Clinton. I mean, he's saying in every speech now, Joe Biden is a friend of mine. I don't remember him saying things like that about Hillary. I think also he, like a lot of Democrats, realize how important the stakes are. Just take one example. In the last few weeks, he's been focusing a lot more on issues like reproductive rights, gay marriage, in order to appeal to women and the LGBTQ community. Well, if you really care about those issues, you've got to be deeply concerned about the federal judiciary and particularly the Supreme Court. It's not Congress that's going to decide those issues. It's not Congress that has decided those issues since Roe v. Wade in 1973. These issues have been these highly controversial, incendiary social issues facing America, issues like abortion, same-sex marriage, religion in the public square, even guns, all of those issues have been decided by the Supreme Court in recent generations, not by the Congress. This is one of the reasons why this helps explain one of the great anomalies in American politics, that 80% of conservative Christians, evangelical Christians, voted for Donald Trump, a man who has been married three times, is an avowed sexual predator, and never goes to church. And so on what possible basis can evangelical Christians justify voting for Trump according to their own value system? Well, it circles back to the Supreme Court. He promised and kept that promise to appoint very conservative judges to the courts that would be right on the issues evangelicals care about. And the court has always been a much more important issue to conservatives than liberals. And so I think one of the things that that Sanders has to understand, has to see, is how consequential this issue is, this election is, for the issues he has been, exactly on the issues he has been campaigning about for the last couple of weeks.
I think one, there may be one other difference as well. 4 years ago, I think it's fair to say, even though it probably didn't affect the outcome, the DNC did kind of have their finger on the scale a bit, and they've been very, very hands-off this time.
Well, yeah, okay. I get that. I mean, but you have not heard as much from Sanders about the system being rigged, mm-hmm. although he always finds someone to blame, right? So he blamed MSNBC for not covering very well. I mean, he is a man full of grievance. I mean, the core of Bernie Sanders' political persona has always been grievance. He's always, if he's not attacking MSNBC, he's attacking millionaires and billionaires, right? I get your point. I do think that in response to Sanders' complaints, the system was changed. And the single biggest change was that these superdelegates, these party officials, who in the past have had outsized influence at the conventions, they still get to go, but they don't have a vote in the first ballot. That was changed directly because of Sanders' complaints.
Yeah, Sanders, I believe, sat on the committee that restructured the rules. So,
But, you know, when you think about the dynamics here, I think we agree that how Sanders handles this is going to be critical, because I teach college and I see my students who have been inflamed by Sanders, and Sanders gets up there and says, we're going to wipe out student debt and we're going to make college free. Kids love it, right?
Of course.
But when people are young in politics, and their emotions get galvanized by someone like Sanders, it's much harder for them to ratchet it back and accept half a loaf. And Sanders has got to take the lead here. He's got to go to his followers and say, okay, he's not a revolutionary. The revolution is not going to happen. But half a loaf is better than none. And in many ways, Sanders' whole career has been predicated on exactly the opposite idea, that half a loaf is not as good as none, that we don't compromise. We don't. That's what revolution means. And he's got to shift gears here if the Democrats have a chance to win, because Donald Trump, even though the polls all show he's very weak on issues like honesty and trustworthiness, he's got an enormous amount of money. He's got a very loyal base, and he is going to be hard to beat by any Democratic candidate. And for Democrats to have even a shot at Donald Trump, they've got to be unified. And if Sanders does not help does not help create that unity, it would be a devastating blow to the Democrats.
If you believe the signals that Sanders has been giving out about his prospective performance in this debate, it sounds like his intent will be to try to pin down Joe Biden on a lot of issues.
Well, yes, and then some of his arguments are fair, and some are not fair. I do think, for instance, when you look at the Iraq War, the people who voted for the Iraq War made a mistake. Now, they will say that they did it based on faulty and even deceptive information that was coming out of the Bush administration. But give Bernie Sanders credit on an issue like that. He was right on that issue. And I think Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden and all those Democrats who voted in favor of the Iraq War now would say that that was a terrible mistake. But there are other issues in which he really is not fair. You take the issue of, quote, the bank bailout, for instance. This is very easy for someone like Bernie Sanders on the left to say, Barack Obama and the Democrats bailed out the banks. They didn't bail out the banks. They bailed out the American economy. Without the bank bailout, we were headed for an enormous financial disaster. And by any fair evaluation, the policies that he is attacking were actually successful. Yes, they helped a lot of banks, but they helped a lot of consumers. They helped a lot of people, small businesses, to survive the downturn of 2007-2008. So Sanders, you know, has his cliches and he has his talking points, and some are fair and some are not. But I do think that you're right. I think he's going to go after Biden on a lot of those votes. And this is one of the reasons why it's so hard for, you know, before John McCain and Barack Obama ran against each other. And so one of those sitting senators had to win the presidency. Only two sitting senators in our entire history had ever been elected president, John F. Kennedy and Warren Harding. Now, there have been senators like previous senators like Richard Nixon, Lyndon Johnson, Harry Truman had all served in the U.S. Senate. They weren't sitting at the time they were elected. But anybody like Biden, 36 years in the U.S. Senate, is going to have a long, long history of votes that can be turned against him. And that's one of the reasons why senators always have so much trouble as presidential candidates.
Yeah, you've taken thousands of votes, and many of those were votes on packages that contained things that you liked and things that you didn't like. And you had to vote yes or no. You didn't get to pick.
Yeah, exactly. And this is one of the reasons, you know, and the nature of the Senate is compromised. Remember that famous malaprop of John Kerry, where he said, well, I voted for that bill before I voted against it, or maybe the other way around.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's exactly what happens in the U.S. Senate every day. But that's the nature of legislative leadership. And that's one of the reasons why it's so hard for career senators to run for president. The landscape has been littered with them. I've covered 14 presidential elections. I've covered a great many wonderful senators, Howard Baker and Bob Dole and countless others who were really, truly fine senators and terrible presidential candidates, partly because legislative leadership is all about blurring edges, bringing people together, forming coalitions. Executive leadership is so different. It's about painting bright lines, not blurring them. It's about a vision, not a compromise. And it's one of the reasons why it's always been, this country has always preferred governors, and in the 19th century, generals. And we did have one general in the 20th century, Eisenhower, obviously. If we go back to the 19th century, we elected a whole bunch of generals. And the reason is that executive leadership it fits much more easily into the mold that we think of as presidential. Legislative leadership, very different business.
We'll return in just a moment with Steve Robert and get your take on the prospects for the actual election in November. We'll return in just a moment in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back with Steve Roberts talking in this segment about his take on the upcoming election in November. The assumption is it's Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Broad picture, how would you handicap the race? What do you think it's going to look like? And whose election is it to lose if it's anyone's?
I think it's Donald Trump's election to lose. You know, obviously, the last few days have deeply rattled the stock markets. I have to believe that the underlying economics are still pretty strong, and that most Americans are going to go into the election feeling good about the economy. It's a big if, right? Because we don't know how the coronavirus is going to play out. We don't know how it's going to affect the underlying economics. We don't know how it's going to affect the national mood. But assuming that the economic news is basically pretty good, Donald Trump has to be the favorite. As I said earlier, one of the things that Democrats have to be deeply worried about is that he started running for re-election on the day he was inaugurated, literally. His campaign has amassed an enormous war chest, and they have a database of over 50 million names on speed dial. So while it's very clear that Donald Trump is a minority president, he's the lowest average of favorable rating in the history of polling for any president. He's never broken 50% in the national averages. He got 46% of the vote in the last election.
And not only low, but completely stable. I looked at the 538 right. average runs between 39 and 43%. There's a stray poll here or there that's above that, but never the average. No other president right. has been anywhere. You look at the other presidents, all of them, there's huge volatilities. Donald Trump's favorability numbers are a straight line.
And if this were a national election where you counted up the votes nationally, I don't think there's any question Trump would not be the favorite. But that's not how we do it. You know, Hillary Clinton kept saying, well, I won the popular vote. She did it win the popular vote by 3 million votes, but that's because she won California by 4 million votes. So there are going to be a lot of wasted Democratic votes out there. And so Trump is much stronger than those numbers would indicate when you think about the Electoral College. And he has a lot of money. He's got a core base of support. He's got, assuming he has a decent economy, he has to be considered a favorite. However, I think there are two, and by the way, the Democrats clearly have not produced a Bill Clinton or a Barack Obama. If it's Joe Biden, he's going to be all of the flaws and all of the weaknesses and all of the drawbacks that Biden is very, very well known for. However, I think there are two other factors. One is, I do think the coronavirus, while we have no idea how it's eventually going to play out, raises the question about leadership, about steadiness, about reliability. You know, the truth is that in many ways, presidential politics is not just voting on what the issues are discussed on the campaign. It's voting on who do you trust in the crisis that you can't foresee. You know, George Bush, 43, he got exactly one question about Islamic terrorism during the campaign. 7 months into his presidency, 9/11 happened, and it totally dominated his next 7.5 years in office. And the coronavirus points up the fact that the nature of the presidency is that unknown and uncalculated crises and challenges are almost certain to happen. And so does this raise the question of Trump's judgment? Does it raise the question of his stability? Does it raise the question of whether people can count on him? Can they trust him in a crisis? And the way he's handled it so far, frankly, I think raises very serious questions about his abilities in a crisis. The second issue is kind of related, but slightly different. And that is, if you look at all of the polling, going back to the exit polling in 2016, 60% of Americans roughly said that Donald Trump was not trustworthy. He was not honest. He was not someone who was a good role model for their children, but 1 out of 5 of those voters who had doubts about his personality voted for him anyway. And that was for many reasons, including hostility to Hillary Clinton. Coming around now, the single biggest question for me is what happens to those voters who are not part of the Trump core, who are not part of that 37 or even 40% of Trump cores. Many of these voters are women. Many of them are moms. Many of them are suburbanites. They are moderate by nature. They might be historic Republicans, particularly in the Middle West. They might have even voted for Trump. But all the surveys show, the Pew survey just recently reinforced this, as I said, when only 1/3 of Americans said that he was either honest or morally upstanding. That's the gap. That's the opening that Democrats can utilize, can exploit. That sense of, do I really want four more years of chaos? Do I want four more years of this show in the White House? And that's where the Democrats have a chance. And that's where Biden's image, old, slow, lethargic, but steady and reliable and sensible. That's the contrast in my mind. I've covered 14 elections, and I think in the end, most Americans do not vote on the basis of policy. They vote on the basis of personality. They vote instinctively. Does he understand me? Does she know what my life is like? Do I like him? And that's where Trump, with some voters, particularly women, could be vulnerable. And that's where the Democrats have their opening.
Trust. And in this case, do you trust the president in the context of what looks like a virus that's going to be around until and beyond Election Day? Well, thank you very much, Steve Roberts. Appreciate your wisdom and your insights. We'll see you next week in the Think Tank. There's so many changes, tears you must hide. Did you ever have to finally decide? Sometimes there's one with big blue eyes, cute as a bunny, with hair down to here and plenty of money. And just when you think she's that one in the world, your heart gets stolen by some mousy little girl.